This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm Sabri Benishour, in for David Brancaccio. Now to Ukraine. According to the Kyiv School of Economics, the war has so far caused up to $600 billion in economic damage. So who's going to pay for that? One logical answer might be Russia. The U.S., Europe, and Japan have all frozen hundreds of billions of dollars worth of Russian assets. So why not use that to cover rebuilding? Well, our next guest argues we might want to think twice about that. Mathieu Favas is finance correspondent for The Economist and joins us. Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's just review first. According to The Economist reporting, Russia has $300 billion of bank reserves in the U.S. and Europe. They're up to $1 trillion of Russian private sector assets out there, outside of Russia. How much of that has been frozen or seized at this point?
So you have to distinguish between the public assets or state assets, which are the central bank reserve that you described, which have been immobilized in a way. They are described as being hindered, basically. That's the technical term for it, which means that the Russian central bank cannot make transactions with it because other parties in the West are forbidden from transacting with the Russian central bank. So in effect, these reserves cannot move, but they're not technically frozen. To be frozen, we would need another legal step to happen. This is not very difficult for governments to do, but it's a nuance. But effectively, they're immobilized. So we can say that the 300 billion are effectively frozen. Now, private assets, it's much less than that. So first of all, you know, this 1 trillion that you mentioned include a big chunk of foreign direct investment, so companies investing abroad. And these investments mostly are not frozen. First of all, because it's hard to know exactly where they are, but also because they're not being targeted directly by sanctions, which leave the assets held by oligarchs, and that amounts to about $400 billion abroad. And out of that, perhaps $50 billion have been frozen. So just a fraction, really.
Several countries in the EU and numerous politicians have said, if Russia is causing $600 billion worth of damage to Ukraine, Russia should pay for that. And we should seize its assets to make that happen. My first question about that is that legal, at least in the US?
It is mostly not. So once again, you need to look at state assets and private assets separately. Perhaps if we start with the private assets, in general, to be able to legally seize private assets, you need a criminal conviction in the courts, and not any criminal conviction or for any crime. You need this crime to be on a specific list with warrant seizure, and not every crime is on that list. So you need a process to get to these assets, which can take years, you know, to prove that these assets have been either the instrument of a crime or linked to the proceeds from it, which is the condition you need to be able to seize them. This is a lot of effort, time and money spent in court. And so if the West was to try and do that, the US or European countries, they would essentially spend a lot of time in front of judges. So that's the private assets. For the state assets, technically, as we said, they're not frozen, so they need to be frozen first before being seized, if they are ever seized. But then most of them generally are covered by what we call the sovereign immunity, so they're protected from lawsuits. But there are, in the US, there's a law that gives sometimes a reason for seizing assets. That's the same law that's used to freeze assets. It provides the legal backing for that action. And typically it doesn't give the right to seize the assets, but there's one exception that was added in 2001, which allows the US government to seize assets if it's at war with another country, in a physical war, an armed conflict. That was the one exception that was used by the Bush administration to seize Iraqi assets in the early 2000s. But right now, you know, America is not at war with Russia, and actually the government is quite at pains to emphasize that that's not the case, that the support that gives to Ukraine by sending it weapons does not amount to it being at war with Russia.
The US, Europe, and Japan have seized assets or frozen assets. What's the difference between that and confiscating those same assets, using them to pay for damage or whatever, what might have you?
The difference is if you freeze assets, they are still there, and the legal owner doesn't change, which means that if you unfreeze the assets, if, you know, we feel that Russia has done enough, has stopped the war in Ukraine, is ready perhaps to pay for some of the damages, then we can return the assets to Russia. If you confiscate the assets, then you change the owner, And then the assets are no longer there. You know, you can give the assets to someone else. You can give them to Ukraine. It's irreversible, whereas freezing is reversible. And that's part of the idea, because when you freeze the assets, you provide an incentive to the targeted country to change its behavior. If you confiscate the assets, then even if the behavior of that country changes, then you can't return the assets.
Let's say the U.S. finds a legal way around, the legal issues of confiscating assets. Is using Russian assets to pay for Russian damage a good idea?
We would argue not, because then if it's proven to be legal, and as we just explained, it's quite a high hurdle, but let's imagine we find a way to make that legal, then you have to look at the strategic consequences of such an action. First of all, we could argue that it makes peace less likely or less easily achievable, because then Russia has a less incentive to agree to peace because the assets are no longer there. And also, we should, you know, generally the objective of freezing the assets is so that the country that is targeted doesn't use the assets, so the money essentially to fund the war that we disagree with, in this case Ukraine. If the assets are frozen, that goal is already achieved. The assets can't be used, so you don't achieve more just by confiscating the assets. But then longer term, also, if you confiscate the assets, like we're doing, using a bit of a legal loophole or something that is, you know, originally was not in our legal statutes, but we try and make an exception for it, then you provide an excuse for other countries worldwide to confiscate Western assets, potentially, or other assets belonging to other countries. And you start to have an international rule of law order that basically starts to collapse. And then also you diminish the confidence that other countries have in the Western financial system, which is a bedrock of its power. That's what enables us to impose sanctions that are pretty effective right now. And if you were to confiscate the assets, you would provide an incentive to non-Western countries to move away from that system.
If the US and Europe cannot use confiscated or seized or frozen Russian assets to make Russia pay for what it's done in Ukraine, is there some other way to compel Russia to pay?
Well, there's two other ways that are being contemplated or considered, because you could try and target not the stock of assets, so the assets that Russia already has abroad, but the flow of assets. Russia earns an enormous amount of money every day from selling oil and gas to, notably to Western countries. You could try and target this amount of money either by imposing a tariff on Russian oil and gas exports, and that's an option that actually the US, Janet Yellen, has argued in front of the G7. It is something that actually would be sensible, but it's quite unlikely. It would be hard for Europe to agree to that as a whole, as a group of 27 countries. There's a lot of disagreements within the bloc. The second possibility would be to hold the revenues that Russia earns into international bank accounts, in escrow accounts, and basically then force Russia to pay some of this money to Ukraine in exchange for this money then to go to Russia. This is something, again, that's being considered. I'm hearing in Washington this is an idea that is perhaps gaining a bit of traction, but again, hard to implement in practice because Russia could just decide not to sell oil and gas to the West. And if the measure then, you know, if the West wants the measure to be extended or to be applied by other countries, then we'd have to perhaps impose some sanctions on these countries as well, which so far we've refrained from doing.
I mean, what do you see as the most likely outcome here?
The most likely outcome, I think, is that things stay as they are, that the West carries on trying to freeze more Russian assets, especially the ones that are the most visible, so the yachts, the private planes. The Russian central bank reserves will remain frozen. I think it will be hard. There's quite big obstacles for then the confiscation to happen. I suspect there may be some efforts or some attempts to do that, but I don't expect they will be very successful. Yes, what I expect rather is for the West to contribute to the reconstruction of Ukraine, because the confiscations are unlikely. And then the end of the war right now seems very far. But typically this is when reparations are agreed. It's not during, you know, whilst the conflict is occurring. So I suspect this is when hopefully we'll see more conversations around Russia, you know, contributing. This may never happen, but this is a more likely time than it is now.
Mathieu Favas is the Economist's finance correspondent. Thank you so much, Mathieu.
Thank you.